This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Al Cooper, has revised and expanded his memoir, Backstage Passes and Backstabbing Bastards, and it's filled with interesting behind-the-scenes stories about pop and rock from the 50s to the 90s. Cooper played in the Blues Project, then founded Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and wrote most of their early songs. He played on Dylan's albums Blonde on Blonde and Highway 61 Revisited, and played the famous organ line on Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone. He's also played on recordings by the Rolling Stones, Jimi Hendrix, and George Harrison, and produced records by Lynyrd Skynyrd, Nils Lofgren, and Rick Nelson. He's now teaching at the Berklee School of Music. He started his career when he was still a teenager. At the age of 14, he became the guitar player in the Royal Teens after they had their hit Short Shorts. And through his new connections, he started writing songs for pop performers, working out of one of the New York buildings on Broadway that headquartered many of the pop writers of the 50s and early 60s. Al Cooper told me how he started getting his songs placed at such a young age.
Well, I met a couple of publishers that were really interested in having as much material to peddle as they could, and they signed me at an early age. I had to actually have my parents' signature in order to be with them. And these were the sort of people that were in 1650 Broadway, and people that were, you know, anxious to gather up as much as possible and then sort of, you know, use a talent colander to find if there was anything good in all these people that they signed.
Your big pop success as a songwriter was This Diamond Ring, which was recorded by Gary Lewis and the Playboys, Gary being Jerry Lewis's son. And you say in your memoir that you wrote that song with an R&B group like the Drifters in mind. So how did it end up being performed by Gary Lewis instead of the Drifters?
Boy, it beats the hell out of me. I was amazed. My publisher at the time, Aaron Schroeder, saw me in the hallway and he said, well, we got a record on that Drifter song you wrote. I said, oh, the Drifters cut it? He said, no. Snuff Garrett cut it. Snuff Garrett was a West Coast producer known for producing Bobby V and people like that. And I said, since when is Snuff Garrett cutting R&B records? He said, well, he's not. I said, oh, dear. He said, well, I have the record. Do you want to come upstairs and hear it? I said, well, just out of curiosity, I'd like to hear what Snuff Garrett did with This Diamond Ring. And so I went upstairs and he played the record and I was just heartsick. I thought it was terrible. I admonished him after he played the record and said, you know, I don't even waste my time playing me things like this again. That's the worst thing I ever heard.
Of course, it became a huge hit.
Yeah, 2 months later, it was number one in the country. And I say, hey, I wrote that song.
Now, what do you think about the arrangement now?
Oh, I still hate it. I still think it's an insipid, horrible record. And as a matter of fact, I went in later years and at much expense to my credibility, recorded the song on one of my solo albums to show people where it came from and what it was like, because I actually think it's a good song. I just couldn't stand the Gary Lewis interpretation.
Okay, we're going to hear both of those versions back to back. We're going to hear the Gary Lewis version and then the version that you cut with the arrangement that you originally had in mind, the version you cut in the 1970s. So here
you know,
we go.
It's even funnier if you play it the other way around. If you play mine first and then play Gary Lewis's, which is, you know, the way I saw it, it's even funnier that way.
I'm willing to give that a shot. Is our engineer ready
okay.
to do that? Our engineer's ready to do that. Let's go. So this is Al Cooper, followed by Gary Lewis's version of Al Cooper's song, This Diamond Ring.
This diamond ring don't shine for me anymore. this diamond ring don't mean what it did before. So if you've got some let it shine for you now. Who wants to buy this diamond ring? She took it off her finger now. It doesn't mean a thing. This diamond ring doesn't shine for me anymore. And this diamond ring doesn't mean
okay, Al Cooper, guess what? I like the Gary Lewis version. I'm not saying I don't like yours, but I like the Gary Lewis version. I think it's a fun pop hit.
Well, so did many millions of people.
Is the interview over now?
It's a sad thing.
No, but it's pop. I mean, it's it's got a...
It's happy. You can do the math to it. It's, you know...
you don't like that kind of like... kettle drum or whatever is on there.
Timpani, no, timpani, it's no. Great in you know, certain things. It was great in the 1812 overture.
So what did the Gary Lewis version do for your career? Did it help it a lot?
Yeah, it helped it tremendously as a songwriter. Right after that, we had another top 20 record by Gene Pitney called "I Must Be Seeing Things," and
want to sing a few bars of that to refresh our memory?
Well, I'll recite the opening lyrics. I used to write the music, and I wrote with two other guys, and they wrote the words, as I was sort of lyrically deficient at the time, and actually lyrically challenged at the time. And this one, typical of its time, said, "Isn't that my girl? And is that my best friend? Aren't they walking much too close together? And it don't look like they're talking about the weather." And then it goes, you know, "Hey, I must be seeing things. This can't be." Like that. That was typical of those songs we wrote at that time.
Well, during this period, you had a lot of musical identities. You were trying to do demos for people. You were writing songs. You would occasionally perform with Paul Simon, the still unknown Paul Simon. You occasionally played at a folk club. You played in rock and roll bands. Which version of you did you want to win out?
I didn't care. I just wanted to, you know, succeed in the music business. That was my goal. I didn't know where and when it was going to happen, and I figured that if you were every place at every time, that you would have more of a chance. I had a way of thinking, as I look back at it, that at that time I was 90% ambition and 10% talent, and now, as I sit here, it's completely reversed. Now I know all this stuff, but I can't be bothered to leave the house.
Why not?
I just can't be bothered. I have no ambition anymore.
Huh. If you're just joining us, my guest is Al Cooper, and he has a new expanded version of his memoir called Backstage Passes and Backstabbing Bastards. Well, in the 1960s, you met Bob Dylan through Dylan's record producer of the time, Tom Wilson, and this was in what year, about?
1965.
65. And Tom Wilson had just cut Dylan's first electric single, Subterranean Homesick Blues, and he invited you to watch Dylan at a session. And you were determined, you say, to do more than watch. You wanted to actually play on it. The session turned out to be the session for Highway 61 Revisited, in which Like a Rolling Stone was recorded. And you played Hammond B3 on Like a Rolling Stone. How did you get to play on it?
Well, I was just determined to play. I was a guitar player at the time, and I stayed up all night practicing, and I had an inflated opinion of my ability as a guitar player. And I got to the session, and at the time I was playing guitar on records as a session musician. So the other musicians that were there early when I got there did not think it was unusual for me to be there with my guitar, because I'd played sessions with them and they knew that I did session work. And I set up my stuff and I sat down and I waited, and Dylan came in with a guitar player who was roughly my age, and he sat down and started warming up, and I realized I was in way over my head. He was the best guitar player I'd ever heard in my life, just warming up. Just the things he was playing were way beyond my grasp as a player, and I said to myself, I got to get out of here before I really embarrass myself. So when there was a moment, I took my guitar and put it in the case and put it against the wall, and I went in the control room where I belonged and watched the session. And Tom Wilson came in, and he hadn't seen me sitting out there with the guitar, so that was very good. And then during the session, they had someone playing the organ, and they moved him over to a piano. Actually, his name was Paul Griffin. He was at studio keyboard player. And I walked over to Tom Wilson. I said, "Hey, why don't you let me play organ on this? I got a great part for this." He went, "Oh, man, you're not a organ player. You're a guitar player. You don't play the organ." And I said, "Oh, yeah, I got a great part for this, Tom." And just at that point, they called him for a phone call. And I thought to myself, well, he didn't say no. He just said I wasn't an organ player. And so I went out and sat down at the organ. And as a matter of fact, if Paul Griffin hadn't have left the organ switched on, that would have been the end of my career, because it's very complicated to turn on a Hammond B3 organ. It takes about three separate moves, and you have to know what you're doing. And I didn't. But it was on already, so I was saved. And then Tom Wilson came back out, and he said, "Okay, this is take six." And then he saw me, and he said, "Hey, what are you doing out there?" And I just started laughing. And he was a gentleman. He just said, okay, let's go. We're rolling. This is take seven. I guess he thought, you know, if I wanted to do this so bad, he would stand behind it because he was my friend.
When you had told Tom Wilson that you had a part worked out in your head, did you really?
No, of course not. 90% ambition.
Okay, so then what happened? They start performing the song.
Well, they were rehearsing for a second, and I kind of got the thing. And the speaker to the organ was very far from where I was sitting at the organ, and it was covered by baffling so that it wouldn't leak into other microphones that were on in the studio. And so I couldn't actually hear what I was playing. And if I put the headphones on, I could kind of hear a little bit of it, but hear the other things that were much louder, like the guitar. And I didn't have any music to read. I had to do it by ear, which I was used to doing because of playing on sessions as a guitar player. And I just kind of, you know, muddled my way through it, and it was the only complete take of the day. So they went in to play it back and listen to it. And during the playback, Dylan went over to Tom Wilson and said, "Hey, turn the organ up." And he said, "Oh, man, that guy's not an organ player." He says, "I don't care, turn the organ up." And that's how I became an organ player.
Well, let's hear Like a Rolling Stone with my guest Al Cooper featured on organ.
You dress so fine, do the bumps of dime in your prime. Then you, people call, say beware doll, you're bound to fall. You thought they were all kidding you. You used to laugh about everybody that was hanging out. So loud. Now you don't seem so proud about having to be scrounging your next meal. How does it feel? How does it feel to be without?
My guest, Al Cooper, featured on organ. Al Cooper, were you surprised at the impact that organ line had on pop music?
Well, I mean, it was ironically hilarious because here's a guy that really didn't know what he was doing, playing Hunt and Peck organ, and like a whole style of organ playing came out of that. It founded like a whole style of organ playing, which, as we sit here, was really based on ignorance. But that's what's so great about rock. That's what makes rock and roll so great, is something like that could happen.
My guest is musician, producer, and songwriter Al Cooper. He's just expanded his memoir. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, musician, songwriter, and singer Al Cooper is my guest, and he has a new expanded version of his memoir, Backstage Passes and Backstabbing Bastards. Now, in your memoir, you write that you used to take records that were people, like bands copying what they heard on Dylan records and play them for Dylan, and that would be really amusing. So I brought in one for you to hear. I don't know if you know this one or not, but this is one that I think is really so inspired by like a Rolling Stone and has a, I don't know, an a kind of cheesy organ or electric piano. I'm not sure which it is that seems to be inspired by your part. So let me play it for you and see what you think.
Since this is your public execution, I think I'm gonna go right on ahead. Mailman brought your letter, babe, where you told me how you feel and about the things he said he told you, and that is I'm such a heel. Well, I could never be honest that to you I'd always lied, but he saw me take some other hide for a two-wheel.
Okay, that was a song.
Don't tell me what it was, because I'm going to tell you what it
oh,
was.
Oh, good. Okay. Go ahead.
That was Mouse in the Traps with A Public Execution.
Correct. And it's one of the records on that great anthology, Nuggets. A little Woolly Bully action in there, too, I think.
Well, yeah, it is, by the way, a very cheesy organ, probably a uh-huh. Farfisa.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, that was one of the records that we laughed at back then.
So you played that for Dylan when it came out?
Well, as we both used to listen to them, it wasn't, you know, we'd like, I'd go to the record store and then we'd go back to his house and we'd put all these records on and just sit there and laugh.
Now, the record that you first made with Dylan, you started in a longer relationship with him, you know, playing with him, and you played with him at the Newport Festival, his first you know, like electric concert, and it's a concert that's famous because Dylan got booed. And in your memoir, you kind of have a different interpretation of why he was getting booed. The standard interpretation is because he had electric instruments, the audience was really angry and thought that he'd sold out, etc., and they were booing him. What's your explanation?
Well, many people came to that festival, which was a 3-day festival, like Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, to see Dylan, because he was like the king of folk music at the time, and he was the headliner of the festival and was playing the final set on Sunday night. And so primarily a college-age crowd came, and they sat through many musics over the 3-day period under the umbrella of folk music that I'm sure that they didn't care for. And most people played 45-minute to an hour sets, and then we came out and we played for 15 minutes, three electric songs. And I think the people were horrified and incensed that we only played for 15 minutes.
But weren't they booing during the performance too, though?
No.
No?
You find me some oral record of that and I'll be very surprised. There was an undercurrent of the festival directors that were very upset with Dylan playing electric. That is a fact, and that is true. But that really had no way of making itself known to the audience that was attending the thing, other than through the press later on, after the festival was over, which is how that myth came to be promulgated. After the festival, that's what the press wrote about, because they were privy to the fact that Pete Seeger and Alan Lomax were very upset with the electrification that Dylan was doing. And in fact, there were other acts that played electric at that festival that nobody got bent out of shape about, like the Chambers Brothers and the Paul Butterfield Blues Band. And they didn't get booed because they played electric.
Al Cooper, he's expanded his rock and roll memoir, Backstage Passes and Backstabbing Bastards. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Al Cooper, who's just updated his memoir about his 40 years in rock and roll. We'll pick things up with the Blues Project, the band he joined in the mid-60s. Their recording, No Time Like the Right Time, is featured on the new Expanded Nuggets anthology. Tom Wilson, the producer who produced Dylan's Highway 61 Revisited, later asked you to play in a band called The Blues Project. You say that there's a lot of tension in the band between, you who really wanted the band to head in a more of a rock direction and Danny Kalb, who wanted it to head in more of a blues direction.
That's true. That was one of the balances in the band, was that sort of, there was a very delicate balance in the band that kept it alive, and if it was ever upset in any way, shape, or form, it could easily topple. And in later years, when we would do reunions and play, get back together again, we had to still maintain that balance, otherwise the band wouldn't work. And it was a weird thing.
From the Blues Project, you moved on to co-founding Blood, Sweat, and Tears. What's the sound you wanted from that band?
Well, I had written a group of songs that, to me, sounded like they would sound best with horns in them. And I brought that idea to the Blues Project, and they said that they didn't want to add horns. So basically, I left the band and went to put together a band that would have horns and that I could perform these songs with.
Why'd you want the horns so much?
The songs just kind of dictated that they have horns in them. I don't know what it was. It was, sort of magic in a way.
Is there a song you want to play that captures the way you wanted to use horns?
Let me think.
Without Her Mammy?
Oh, no. That was an adjunct. It really didn't. That didn't best describe the band. I would say probably I Can't Quit Her or I Love You More Than You'll Ever Know. Either one of those.
Okay.
Or My Days Are Numbered.
Why don't we hear I Love You More Than You'll Ever Know, and we'll start this a little deep into it where the horns start to become prominent. This is Blood, Sweat, and Tears. My guest is Al Cooper.
When I wasn't making too much money, where my paycheck went. You know I brought it home to baby, and I never spent one red cent. Is that a way for a man to carry on? You think it won't, his little
left one gone. I love you, baby, more than you'll ever know, more than you'll ever know. But I could be everything that you demand. I could be president of General Motors, baby, or just a tiny little grain of sand. Is that in a way for a man to carry on? You think he wants his little loved one gone?
Cooper, had you worked with horns like this before?
There was a period in my life where I wrote ghost arrangements, and I wrote for horns in that situation. But I had not really been in a band with a horn section, no. I had admired Maynard Ferguson's jazz group, which had a large horn section, and that was sort of my model for Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
I think Blood, Sweat, and Tears was pretty influential in inspiring other bands to bring horns in and to kind of incorporate something of a jazz sound.
Yeah. I think it was probably Chicago and BS&T that were equa influential. They were both germinating at the same time. It's just that the Blood, Sweat, and Tears record came out first, but Chicago was also working in the same time period that we were.
My guest is Al Cooper. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Al Cooper. He's revised and expanded his memoir. Cooper founded Blood, Sweat, and Tears and wrote most of their early songs. Now, after a while, David Clayton Thomas was brought in to replace you as the lead singer. What's the story behind that?
If I tell you, there'll be seven other people that will tell you seven different stories of what happened. So I just have to say that, because I've found in my life that that's what happens. Steve Katz would tell you a completely different story than this, and Bobby Columbia would tell you a completely different story than Steve Katz and myself, and we were all there at the same time.
What's your story?
So, my story is that unlike the Blues Project, where we did everything together, if we weren't playing or on the road and we were back home in Greenwich Village where we lived, we would go to the movies together, we would go out to eat together, we even had one rock group therapy session together in a bid to save the band. So when Blood, Sweat, and Tears was formed, I decided that really hadn't worked very well in the Blues Project to spend so much time with everybody, and I did the opposite of that. And I was just getting married at the time, and so I would go to rehearsals and concerts and play with the band, and then I would go home and spend the time with my wife. But what happened was the other people were all hanging out together like bands do, and there was a faction that was conspiring against me in my direction that the band would go in, and in fact me singing lead and stuff like that. And it finally came to a head, and I was just sort of forced into leaving the band, and I did. And they auditioned several people. As a matter of fact, Laura Nero was, a possibility of being the lead singer with the band. And a blind blues singer named Bobby Doyle, they also were considering. But David Clayton Thomas got the job. He was an R&B singer from Canada. And he replaced me as the singer. And the trombone player when I was in the band, Dick Halligan, replaced me as the organ player, which is pretty funny.
Well, I guess this is my opportunity to confess that I'm not a big fan of David Clayton Thomas, so I was wondering what your reaction was to his singing.
Well, I thought that he was he had a great instrument. He had a really good voice, but I didn't believe a word he sang.
Very showbiz?
Yeah, I mean, just to my taste, I didn't think he was a bad singer at all. In fact, he was a much better singer than I was. There was no doubt about that. But like I said, I had that credibility problem with. I mean, I don't consider myself a great singer, but I do believe everything that I sing. I wouldn't sing anything I didn't believe. That's why, you know, I try to write my own material, because then I'm really expressing, the true way that I think, although I find other people's songs that I can sing and feel, you know, that I can represent what they're saying. I didn't believe David Clayton Thomas, but again, same thing as This Diamond Ring. You know, what do I know? They became huge.
Right.
They had number one record and had Grammys and...
Yes, exactly, and I can't help but wonder how you felt after leaving the band to watch the band become this huge success.
Well, to tell you the truth, most of that album, the second album, were songs that I had picked for the band and done the arrangements for, and so I felt a part of it. I sort of felt vindicated. I said, "Yeah, you know, this is this idea that I had, and people seem to actually like it, and it's taken a funny turn here because I'm not in it." And then I thought, "Well, this is great. I don't have to go all over the world and play in all these places and everything, and I still get the same satisfaction knowing that this idea that I had worked," which is sort of the way I thought back then. And that was great, except that I never got any financial remuneration for it.
Right. I want to jump ahead to the present. You said that you now think of yourself as 90% talent and 10% ambition, which is the opposite of what you were when you were starting out. What are the projects that you are involved with now or have been involved with lately that have given you the greatest pleasure?
Well, the greatest pleasure in my life is I teach now at the Berklee College of Music in Boston. And I moved there, in fact, specifically to do that. And teaching my classes is sort of the high point of my life right now. Something I really enjoy doing.
What do you like about teaching?
I feel, A, I'm giving something back, and B, I'm dealing with a room full of people who really don't know the things that I'm teaching them, and that they will benefit, I think, tremendously by having that knowledge in their arsenal when they go out into the world.
They probably also don't know your records, at least not at first.
No, they have no idea who I am.
Right, so how does that make you feel?
Good. I mean, I wouldn't expect that they would. I mean, their parents certainly know who I am.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no way they would know who I am, because they're like 17 to 21 years old. And so, I know that going in.
And what have you been doing musically? Are you still writing songs?
I'm still writing songs. I have a studio in my house, and I write the song, and then I go down to the basement and record it, and it gets released in my living room. And that's about it.
Yeah, it's not the surest way to climb the charts.
Well, I'm a legend in my own home and a rumor in my own house.
Well, are you anxious to record or have other people record the new songs that you're writing?
Oh, sure. Everyone's always anxious to do that. The problem is that in the music business, you get sort of a certain window of opportunity. And when that window closes, if you don't respect that, then you could, you know, hang yourself, jump out a window, take an overdose of pills. It's very frustrating because here you think this is going to last your whole life, and you really have to, you know, take stock of the situation and be prepared for that eventuality when that window shuts, because it always shuts when you don't want it to shut, and it always kind of slams on your fingers. And it's a difficult time. But I always knew that it was coming, and I, like, kind of waited for it, like stepped outside myself and said, is this it? Is this it yet? Oh, could this be it? And so I was always ready for that. And in fact, I just put like a storage pile of things that I wanted to do after that so that I wouldn't find myself, you know, hanging myself or jumping out a window or anything.
Teaching was one of those things?
Yeah. Yeah. And I would like to also have a disc jockey show and play old rhythm and blues records and sort of educate people the way I do in school. And write books. Like, now I have, you know, my book is out now, and I'm excited about that, and probably would want to, you know, do more stuff like that. I write a column for a magazine every month, and I really enjoy that. And, you know, a chance to do all these things I didn't have time to do before because I was so caught up in the music business.
You know, you write in your book that aging in pop business is always held against you, that, you know, if you're older, you're seen as not being cutting edge anymore and, you know, therefore washed up.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty accurate portrayal of the music business.
Mm-hmm.
Except maybe, you know, in the blues area where they respect seniority.
That's true. That is really true, yeah. It's true in some rock and roll, too, like, you know, I mean, the Rolling Stones can get as old as whatever.
Oh, yeah. No, there are exceptions to the rule, and there are people that are really fortunate enough to keep going, but there are many that don't. And the other thing is that, you know, take a person like Bob Dylan or Sly and the Family Stone. These are people that made incredible music, and yet the society is geared up and insist that they must continue doing that for the rest of their lives, or they're horrible people, or they're washed up, they're through. But I mean, if you look at the body of work that Sly and the Family Stone left us, it doesn't matter if he writes another song again. He changed music forever and was an incredibly strong influence on the way music is being played today in the R&B field. Everyone owes a debt to him. And yet, you know, people go, he's through, he's a drug casualty. He is none of those things. He is a strong influence in the history of music.
A very good point. Al Cooper, I really appreciate your talking with us, and I want to thank you very much.
It was my pleasure.
Al Cooper, his memoir is called Backstage Passes and Backstabbing Bastards.